You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. This is Emma Nelson coming up on today's show.
Demography politics and confessional politics have changed this picture totally, plus oil and energy and the globalised economy.
From Iraq and Vienna to London and North Korea, we discuss the day's top stories here in the studio with Xenia Dormandy and Alessio Patilano. Then the latest edition of Monocle is on newsstands now, and it's our big annual Quality of Life edition. Today we hear from Robert Bound, our culture editor, who asks if cities have a use-by date.
So if I'm too old for the German capital, am I too young for stately, staid Paris? Would Rio drive me crackers while I marvelled at the Cariocas? Should I really head north to solid Stockholm? Or is Madrid the happy medium of museum pieces with late nights included as standard?
And later in the show. We have a special guest to review the latest music. All that, plus a special visit from Brazil's ambassador to the UK only a little more than an hour before their big match with Mexico in the World Cup. That's Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, starting right now. But before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
Heavy fighting is continuing between Iraqi government forces and Islamist insurgents. At one stage, the rebels took control of the city of Bakuba, which is less than 40 miles away from Baghdad. Iraq's government has accused Saudi Arabia of supporting the militants, an allegation rejected by Saudi authorities. The United States says it will send almost 300 troops to protect its diplomatic staff. The UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon says it's vital to stop Iraq falling apart.
The Iraqi government should have one state, whether it is a Sunni or Shiite or Kurds. They should be able to harmoniously live together, respecting and upholding human rights and values of the United Nations.
Britain has announced it's to reopen its embassy in Iran after 3 years. That news amid reports that Tehran could join Western powers in trying to defeat insurgents in Iraq. The UN has warned the Middle East is on the verge of a wider war as the violence in Syria spills over into Iraq. In a report, inspectors warn radical Islamist insurgents are kidnapping, torturing and killing civilians. But the chair of the UN's independent inquiry on Syria, Paolo Pinheiro, says that forces loyal to the Assad regime are also accused of a series of attacks.
The conflict in Syria has reached a tipping point, threatening the entire region. We recently received and have begun to investigate thousands of photographs of bodies of persons allegedly killed in government military facilities.
Officials in the United States say the suspected ringleader in the raid on a U.S. diplomatic post in Libya has been captured. 4 Americans, including the ambassador Chris Stevens, died in the attack in Benghazi more than 18 months ago. The Pentagon says the suspect, Ahmed Abu Katala, was detained over the weekend. Kenya's president says local political networks, not Islamist militants, were behind the latest attack in the country, in which 15 people were killed. It's thought a number of women were also abducted in the overnight raid on 2 villages near the town of Mpeketoni. The Somali group Al-Shabaab says it carried out the attacks, but the president, Uhuru Kenyatta, says that's not true.
The attack in Lamu was well-planned, orchestrated, and politically motivated ethnic violence against the Kenyan community. This, therefore, was not an Al-Shabaab terrorist attack. Evidence indicates that local political networks were involved in the planning and execution of the heinous crime.
A Russian television network says a reporter has died in Ukraine after a mortar attack. It happened during clashes between government forces and pro-Russian separatists near to Luhansk. Igor Korneliuk died in hospital. His colleague is still missing. China is to become a major investor in a number of large-scale projects in Britain. Chinese Premier Li Keqiang has signed an agreement in London after talks with the British Prime Minister David Cameron. It includes plans for Chinese funding of new nuclear power stations in the UK and a new high-speed rail link from London to the north of England. Mr. Cameron says it's a significant development.
Today we have signed deals worth more than £14 billion, securing jobs and long-term economic growth for the British and Chinese people. Ours is truly a partnership for growth, reform and innovation. But second, our partnership goes well beyond the economic field. The UK recognises that the rise of China is one of the defining events of our century.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Paul will be back in a little under half an hour's time to bring us a quick roundup of the latest world headlines. In a moment, though, we take a slightly deeper view of the day's events. Stay with us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
The time here in London is 18.06, nearly 18.07, 13.06 in New York. Let's take on today's news agenda today. Here in the studio to help us is Xenia Dormandy, Project Director of the US Programme and the Acting Dean of the Academy at Chatham House, and Dr. Alessio Patilano, Lecturer in East Asian Warfare and Security at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme, both regulars and both ready and rary to go. Let's begin the show in Iraq. The US is now to deploy troops, 275 personnel will offer backup and support to the US citizens already there. And as President Obama has said, they are equipped for direct fighting. This news comes alongside the continuation of heavy fighting between Iraqi government forces and Islam insurgents. At one stage, the rebels, the ISIS rebels, have taken control of the city of Bakuba, and that's less than 40 miles away from Baghdad. Every time we approach this subject, both of you, this story is moving faster than we can ever really keep a handle on. But Alessio, explain to us what you believe the significance of the return of boots on the ground in Iraq is.
Well, I think that one has to be very careful to qualify. We're talking about 275 men for the moment. That's what news is telling us. So it's a relatively small, highly specialised group of individuals. And there is talk at the moment also to send back some special forces to contribute to train the Iraqis. So it seems to me that the message is quite clear. The President Obama had a serious problem to deal with. That is not creating a situation of insecurity for the embassy. Especially in light of events a couple of years ago, so war had something had to be done, but he's been very very precise, very surgical in his decision, and I think that is the interesting element of the story. We should be very careful not to qualify this necessarily as boots of the ground, or there's a very interesting series of headlines. It's back on how it sends U.S. troops into Iraq. It sounds like something is going back, but actually that's not quite the case. We're looking at something very specific to plug into a concern that probably united both the aisles of Congress and US.
Xenia, precise, surgical.
Yes, I mean, this actually reinforces everything that we've seen in Obama. It's not that he's afraid of using American forces. It's that when he uses American forces, it is targeted, it is precise, it is to achieve a certain objective. As Alessio says, this is about a response to the events in Libya, when four American diplomatic officers, including the ambassador, were killed in Benghazi. And Obama, two, 3 years later, is still dealing with the after effects of that politically. And so this is very, very clear. It's 275 personnel, largely to protect the embassy and the embassy personnel. That's it. He is not sending boots on the ground back into Iraq. He is not again getting into a military engagement in Iraq. The more interesting kind of point, again picking up on the targeted, is the fact that actually, as opposed to a decade ago, Well, that's perhaps a little unfair, but this has come along with the recognition that America needs to be talking to Iran about what goes on in Iraq, and that this cannot be resolved without kind of some kind of agreement or some kind of a loose engagement with Iran. And that's also taking place. That, to me, is the monumental, or not monumental, but the bit that we should be focusing on.
We'll have a go at Iran in a moment. What we shall do first, though, if that's all right with you, is hear from Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard. This is his view of Obama's decision.
There is tremendous reluctance all the way around to commit boots on the ground. It's a favourite thing, a phrase of journalism. But President Obama will be aware that not one of his European allies would join him in that, and that has been stated explicitly. He's got a huge problem, as has the allies, because what I don't think that they're really acknowledging to themselves sufficiently is that this really is a new situation. It's no use going back. Yes, we've heard about the divisions in the Sykes-Picot Agreement in 1916, and then 1919 and 1920, Versailles and Sèvres, and the British and the French were the Weasley so-and-sos were responsible for creating the Middle East. Demography, politics, and confessional politics have changed this picture totally, plus oil and energy and the globalised economy.
That was Robert Fox there from London's Evening Standard. Alessia Patalana, you were nodding vigorously at what Robert Fox was saying there, but is there not accusations now being levied at Obama that this is an indirect or even direct consequence of the United States' inaction when it came to Syria?
Well, I think it is difficult to... certainly there is a connection there. The nature of that connection, I think we need time still to figure it out. And in this respect, what I found particularly interesting, well, actually worrisome, was, and we discussed this before on the show, this was how sort of Tony Blair interjected into this entire debate, saying, like, you know, it was not what we've done 10 years ago. I think one link that certainly we can establish is that the operations in 2003 prepared the ground for the current situation. They basically destroyed whatever infrastructure institutionally that existed in Iraq, never really replaced it fully. And I think at the moment, what they're trying to do, and I think what is interesting, and let me re-emphasize this because Ken is absolutely right, what we're looking at is an Obama administration that is trying to mobilize not just military power, because that's the big difference, right? They are operating at the political diplomatic levels. They are also in sort of deploying highly specialized forces. This is a much more nuanced, articulated way to approach the crisis that we've seen in a very long time. I think so. For the time being, you know, focusing on the positive side is not necessarily a bad thing. You see,
I think we have to in a situation like this. Anyway, you wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd pick up is I'm sure many of us will remember about 2 weeks ago, President Obama gave this kind of what was termed by the U.S. administration the kind of historic speech at West Point that was supposed to lay out for the American people and the international community how he saw, you know, what was the Obama doctrine, how he saw American engagement in the world, what was he trying to achieve. Now, that speech was responded to pretty negatively, both within the United States and internationally. But what it made emphasized was that the military tool is not necessarily the right tool for all challenges, and that in fact America was going to very much focus on some of the other tools, the diplomatic, the economic, energy, etc., etc. And this is a great example. I mean, morally, we hate the idea of what's going on in Syria, and yet most people seem to be a little bit confused by what we might be able to do in Syria with military forces. You know, if America would put boots on the ground, or anybody would put boots on the ground, would that really do the job? What Obama has said very, very clearly, or what Kerry has said very, very clearly, what the U.S. administration has said very, very clearly in Iraq, is the solution to this is Maliki reaching out to the Sunnis. He has to bring the Sunnis into the party, into the system, so that it is a Iraq for all people. Without that, no military activity by the West, or frankly by the Iraqis, is actually going to succeed. I think what the Americans are waiting to see is, you might see more from America, you might see more resources, whether it's military or other resources, be put to the table if Maliki actually starts reaching out, and that he is not doing.
This is something that has been mentioned though for some time though in terms of the role that Nouri al-Maliki has played in dividing his own country. In a moment we'll hear from Barrier Alamuddin, who makes some very, very strong allegations about what Nouri al-Maliki's image is. But given this situation that you know, Nouri al-Maliki finds himself politically isolated, to what degree can he galvanise a country which in theory is on its way to being split into three parts?
I think at the moment it's very difficult to see how he's going to do that. And you know, in a situation like the one we have in Iraq, I think one of the biggest problems is that some of the foundations of any sort of working state, that is its core institutions, including the police and the military, they seem to be falling apart to a degree. So that in itself is not going to help. And on top of that, again, reaching out, absolutely essential. You're absolutely right. But at the same time, I don't see any sort of plan at the moment in trying to do so. In fact, the issue is that this is seen as a zero-sum type of game. You know, Iraq is going to be unified only if he goes on with these type of plan, these type of views. But I don't think that is possible. The degree of compromise has to be reached.
There's a degree of self-determination as well, which Iraq really does need to sort of address in this terms. I referred a moment ago to Barrier Alamuddin, the foreign editor of Al Hayat, earlier on Monocle 24. She talked about Iran's role in all this. Well, let's now explore the potential that Iran may have in terms of what influence it has on in the crisis with the ISIS terror group sort of making its way across Iraq at the moment. This is what she had to say earlier on about the role that Iran has been playing in this crisis.
And of course, we know that Iran has played a very, very big role in this crisis, in the sense that you have advisors sitting in the prime minister's office, Maliki. We have a Maliki who has grown to be, if not a Saddam Hussein, very close to Saddam Hussein. Other people think he's worse. He really sort of worked into this crisis of Sunni-Shia conflict with the help, of course, of Iran. The United States said clearly, and I've spoken to people in the administration saying, no, this is not about going to battle with the Iranians in any way or form. We talk to them about Afghanistan. We talk to them about other things. We just want them to play a positive role in creating a new government in Iraq, not led by Maliki, and a coalition government that will bring in Sunnis and Shias. Because for the last 8-10 years with Maliki rule, he has alienated the Sunni population in Iraq in every single way.
Alessia, you were mentioning there about the role of Iran. Let us for one moment turn into the way that Iran can play a role. And it seems to have a linchpin to it. Something, Xenia, in your project director of the US program at Chatham House, to what degree is the US now the linchpin in making Iraq and Iran talk to each other?
I don't think the US is a linchpin. I mean, one of the things that has come out of the US administration is very much, you know, yes, we have to talk to Iran about Iraq. Both of us have to be involved. But actually, this is about Iraqis finding their own solution. And we're not going to impose a solution on Iraq. But there is a recognition. And again, I mean, if you go back over a decade now to Afghanistan, where there was a recognition there, but little was done, unfortunately, to pick up that opportunity of recognizing that you have to involve the countries in the region, that yes, we have borders, but those borders can be very, very loose. As we saw negatively between Syria and Iraq today, we also have to recognize that Iran plays a very significant role, and that unless you bring Iran into the conversation, and not just into the conversation, but unless maybe coordination might be too strong, but at least working together and making one another aware of interests and how one might be able to work together, that's going to be a very, very important part, not just of managing what's happening in Iraq, but also engaging and putting leverage on Maliki as is appropriate.
In fact, the US Secretary of State John Kerry has said, we're open to discussions if there's mm-hmm. something constructive that can be contributed by Iran, if Iran is prepared to do something that's going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq. What can Iran do?
Well, I mean, here's the thing, is you have to recognise that actually neither Iran nor the United States want a chaotic Iraq, and neither of them, particularly not Iran, want a Iraq that is a fermenting kind of hotbed of Sunni extremism. They are even more interested, perhaps, than we are to make sure that that eventuality doesn't come to pass. And so there are opportunities for Iran and the US to potentially, and Iraq. And again, one has to emphasize the fact that Iraq can't be kept out or can't be an afterthought of this. They have to participate in this. But the fact that Iran and the US and Iraq, parts of Iraq anyway, have similar interests, we can actually work together. We have resources, we have leverage, we have political leverage. It's not just about the military. And we have economic leverage potentially as well. And so there are ways to work together. The other thing I would say is we also, you know, we know that the negotiations are currently taking place between the P5 plus one P5 plus one and Iran on Iran's nuclear status. This also could provide another avenue to kind of improve those relationships that would actually help that broader conversation. So, I mean, I think we need to take advantage of it, and it appears that John Kerry is.
Let's move on to this. Iran, as you say, new nuclear talks are being held in Vienna, 5 days of talks between Iran and the P5 plus one. The issue of military cooperation hasn't, by all accounts, been mentioned. The focus is still on Iran's nuclear programme. But, Alessio, from the your perspective, how could the ISIS-Iraq crisis actually influence the way that diplomacy could be done in Vienna?
I think what we are looking at is a situation. We're in for a bumpy road. That's certainly the case, in the sense that obviously you can see this both as an opportunity, as a challenge. As an opportunity because, of course, you've got an additional crisis, so you've got an additional reason to actually have a stronger, more robust, more substantial dialogue and exchange with the Iranians. But at the same time, you can't certainly go to the negotiating table given the impression that you're willing to negotiate in order to achieve a better sort of situation in Iraq, say like, well, you know, we open to discussion about your nuclear program. So I think that is that it works both ways. We'd certainly have a new, stronger avenue for the communication and the exchange, but a very tricky and a slippery one, because the Iranians might very well turn around and say like, well, you know, whether we start talking about how far you want to sort of put a break on our nuclear program, given the situation in Iraq in front of us.
Very briefly, do you think Iran holds more cards than it did before?
I don't. I'm with Alessio. I don't think it's a question of holding more cards. He's absolutely right. You have another topic of discussion, another opportunity to work together, another card to lever and to work with. But if the interests diverge, then you've actually also got another obstacle. You've got another potential area where the two sides can actually split and cause challenges in it. What we do know is that the negotiations between the P5 plus one and Iran have been going very slowly. There are still quite significant gaps. But there's also, to the extent that one can tell, and they really are keeping the results of the negotiations very private, but there also does appear to be some hope on both sides that some kind of conclusion will be reached in the next few weeks, which is the deadline that they have set themselves.
Xenia Dormandy and Alessio Patalano will be with us, once I've learned how to say Alessio's name properly, in a few moments' time, when we'll be talking China and North Korea. So stay with us.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
'24 here in London. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. With me is Xenia Dormandy from the think tank Chatham House and Dr. Alessio Patalano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Let's talk now to the United Kingdom, where the Chinese Premier Li Keqiang is currently on a visit. Lots to talk about here, Alessio, not least because there's been a big build-up of complaints, perhaps, by the Chinese towards their inability to do business in London and do business in the United Kingdom over the last few years. Visa issues, the cost of doing business, Europe, all these barriers that seem to have been put up. Is this the moment when these barriers are suddenly ripped down, torn down, and everyone becomes friends again?
Well, on the surface, that is certainly part of the message, but I would be slightly more cautious in terms of the reality of it. The reality is that, of course, you wanted to favour business. Of course, you wanted to improve the visa process. I am sort of constantly involved personally in this because I do host sort of scholars from China. And, you know, to have sort of, especially in the defence and security fields, to have visa, it's not always the easiest thing. So it is very much welcome, the fact that the Prime Minister put on the agenda, the fact that there will be no new procedures to facilitate that. That being said, however, the economy sort of investments, Chinese investments in Britain has been consistent and has been consistently growing. So in that respect, it's more to favour tourism, sort of cultural exchanges, and of course, to increase even more the economic element. That being said, perhaps, I would say that there is a slightly more sort of complicated aspect to do this, and that is we're coming at the end of a very difficult period in Sino-British relations because of the meeting between Cameron and Dalai in 2012. So I think that really was one of the key elements behind the symbolism of this visit. This is perhaps important precisely because it suggests that we're back to business as usual.
We're back to business as usual, but Xenia, just as working a little further what Alessio said there, this issue of the visit to the Dalai Lama by the British Prime Minister David Cameron prompted a 3-year diplomatic freeze. Towards Cameron at least, others such as Boris Johnson from London made absolute hay. But to what degree does this reignition of relations between China and the United Kingdom actually raise questions about how the United Kingdom deals with its human rights?
I mean, here's the thing to remember. I mean, there's allies and there's allies, or there's friends and there's allies. You know, I mean, you've got, and I'm going to take extremes here for one moment, but you've got the US and the UK that can deal with all sorts of problems, Iraq, you know, the Snowden revelations, and they don't actually have an impact in the kind of broader exchange. And then you've got, you know, the UK and China, just to take an example, where the reality is that all sorts of small, minor, and some major challenges can actually get in the way. Can the UK talk to the Chinese about human rights? Yes, they will. I'm sure it'll be a talking point that Cameron will privately engage during the visit. But can Cameron publicly go and visit the Dalai Lama or have the Dalai Lama visit him? No. Absolutely not. And that will, as we saw, for 2 years, essentially stymie public engagement. And what the Chinese will do is they'll say, well, OK, we're not going to engage with you, the UK, but suddenly we're going to invest huge resources and energy in Germany and in France. And they're very good at using the kind of the different interests of the different European nations in many cases to achieve their objectives. And if you don't do what we want, we'll go elsewhere. But what is an indication of is this is a very transactional relationship and it's a very sensitive relationship, and we shouldn't assume that everything is now glowing because something else will get in the way.
China has had, obviously, in reigniting its relationship with the United Kingdom in terms of trade, is it doing what Xenia has just said, namely turning its back on the likes of France and Germany, who it has had difficulties with in terms of trade to do with the European Union regulations, and now trying to find a better business partner?
Well, I think there is certainly an element of that. Now, let's clarify a few points. The Chinese ambassador likes very much Harry Potter, which is an important element.
I'm interested to see where you're taking
this. but you know, we know that there are elements on the surface that they try to sort of advertise as like, oh, look, everything is fine. The truth is, however, that if you are in Europe, and that is true for Berlin, Paris, Rome, London, truth is you spend half of your time trying to not having the Chinese turning your relationship off, and the other half of the time to switch them back on. I was, you know, consistently, every time I go to China and I interact with the people in the embassy, they're terrified. Anything that is going to happen, you don't know what is going to happen, that is going to sort of unleash Chinese anger. And literally overnight, you have officials of the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs not answering the telephone. And I think that in general is a fundamental problem. And again, it's a problem not just for the type of relationship that you can nurture, but also in terms of how far you can develop a substantial agenda. And I think Sanya is absolutely right. It's a very transactional way of looking at it. And it does raise the question of the extent to which the Chinese are actually interested in substantial, long-lasting relationship rather than business operations, as it were.
We'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid, to say. Zenia Dormandy and Alessia Patilano, thank you very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Robert Bound will ask if cities have a use-by date. We'll chat with Brazil's ambassador to the United Kingdom, who's taking a little bit of time out before his country's team kicks off against Mexico at 20:00 hours London time. And we'll hear some new music chosen by the musician Ahmed Galab, or otherwise known as Sin Kane. But before that, before we get started on that, here's Paul with the latest world headlines.
Through the day, there's been heavy fighting between Iraqi government forces and Islamist insurgents. At one stage, the rebels took control of Bakuba, a city which is less than 40 miles from Baghdad. Earlier, Iraq's government accused authorities in Saudi Arabia of supporting the militants, a charge they've denied. The United States has said it will send almost 300 troops to Baghdad to protect its diplomatic staff. Meanwhile, Britain has announced it will reopen its embassy in Iran after 3 years. That news came amid reports that Tehran could join Western powers in trying to defeat insurgents in Iraq. Elsewhere, officials in the United States say the suspected ringleader in the raid on a U.S. diplomatic post in Libya has been captured. 4 Americans, including the ambassador Chris Stevens, died in the attack in Benghazi in September 2012. The Pentagon says the suspect, Ahmed Abu Qatala, was detained in a secret raid in Libya at the weekend. And Kenya's president has said local political networks, and not Islamist militants, were behind the latest attack in the country. 15 people were killed in overnight strikes on 2 coastal villages, and it's thought a number of women were abducted as well. The Somali group Al-Shabaab says it carried out the attacks, but Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta has said that's untrue. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news headlines. And then after that, Tom Morris will be here, our design editor, to bring us this week's episode of Section D, Monocle 24's Design Now. But in the meantime, you're with Midori House. This is Emma Nelson, where the time here in London is 18:33. It's 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro, a city we'll be hearing a little bit more about in the next few minutes as we welcome the Brazilian ambassador to the United Kingdom into our studio in a few minutes' time. But the latest edition of Monocle is on our newsstands now, and it's our big annual quality of life edition. And all this week on Midori House, we've been speaking to our editors and correspondents and finding out what makes a city great. Today we hear from Robert Bound, our culture editor, who asks if cities have a use-by date.
Two men walk into a bar and find the place has been turned into a sushi joint or a burger bar if you're in London. Someone save us from the tyranny of the tattooed patty parlour. Have you ever been one of those men looking for the bar? Felt that you weren't the target audience for a place? That someone's having fun in the city in which you find yourself, but it's not quite you, and you're not quite sure why? It makes you wonder if cities have a use-by date, that there's an age at which you, the visitor, are best suited to explore the flora, fauna, fruits and flesh pots of certain cities. There are towns that will make you feel like a one-man stag night for ordering a second beer, and there are places where you'll seem like a granddad at the disco for wondering if there's anywhere to sit down, and for using the word disco. I'm back and forth to Berlin a lot at the moment, the loneliness of running the long-distance romance, and I get the feeling that I might not be quite its target market, that I'm a Johnny Common Spätli to the promised land of postcode-sized loft apartments for peanuts, where art flows deeper than the Spree, and where everyone's throwing a party. In the West, I can sit on a Weimar banquette and order a wicked whiskey sour. But in the East, I feel that the identity hipsters just know I own an iron and hate me for it. So if I'm too old for the German capital, am I too young for stately, staid Paris? Would Rio drive me crackers while I marvelled at the cariocas? Should I really head north to solid Stockholm? Or is Madrid the happy medium of museum pieces with late nights included as standard? How deep should you have to dig under the streets of Zurich to find the gold? The answer depends upon the sprightly 70-year-old who applies Samuel Johnson's tired of London, tired of life dictum to all places equally, as much as to the 20-somethings who fancy a quiet street on which to bring up their young family. You're as young as you feel, but the view from your kitchen window and the likelihood of waking to birdsong on a sunny Saturday can't help but fashion your feeling for a city. Practically speaking, city use-by dates might be done in the style of Margaret Calvert's British road signs. In place of a stick man with a shovel denoting roadworks, we'd have a stick man stick dancing, stick dining, stick sunbathing, depicted by the stick shovel deployed as stick parasol, stick exploring, and finding stick romance. It's not as rude as it sounds. Fancy a gastronomic weekend? Search for the not-so-stick figures hunkered over a perilously loaded stick table. But really, the use-by date is just a guide, like strawberries on a box of cereal, a serving suggestion. And as for those thirsty men, they went to the bar next door and had a whale of a time.
That, of course, was Robert Bowne, Monocle's culture editor. Make sure you tune in tomorrow on Midori House for another edition of Quality of Life Essays. David Michon will be talking smart cities. Up next, though, on Midori House today, the Brazilian ambassador to the UK joins me to talk World Cup, soft power and much more. Stay tuned.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
Every other summer, the international architecture community sail into Venice to contemplate the world of architecture. This year's Biennale, curated by Rem Koolhaas, was a fundamental study in modernity and national identity. Monocle Films reports back.
Although patriotism has long been at the heart of the Biennale, with each of the handsome national pavilions lined up in the Giardini, Koolhaas's theme invites reflection on the notion of national style, instead of posturing, self-promotion or peacocking.
Soft Power Ambassadors at the Venice Architecture Biennale, now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And a very warm welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Now, it is a little over an hour until the most important match in today's World Cup, Mexico-Brazil. And for my next guest, at least, the most important match so far. We are delighted to say we have persuaded Brazil's ambassador to the United Kingdom, Ambassador Roberto Jaguaribe, to join me in the studio. We promise, Ambassador, we won't keep you until kickoff. Well, we're off air at 1900 hours London time anyway. Are you ready for today's match? I'm assuming you're not playing in it.
Well, that's, fortunately for me, because I'm so anxious that I wouldn't perform well at all. But of course we are ready, but it's always a little anxious. And the psychological pressure of the World Cup on players of any country is enormous. But I think Brazilians have always the big expectation, especially playing at home. So it's always very special, but we're ready.
I mean, you could possibly replace the World Cup, this particular match, then, with the preparations up to the World Cup itself, the anxiety, the build-up to the tension. do you feel now as if you can breathe a sigh of relief now that things are happening and that nothing terrible has happened so far? And I mean, just looking at the front cover of the Folha Sao Paulo, it says that you know, even the flights are running more on time than they ever have done before. Is this a moment when you can actually relax?
Well, you have to be very attentive to every detail. Of course, I'm not responsible for those things in Brazil, but I am anxious about everything. But I was always very, very certain that everything would go well. You know, Brazil is a very passionate country and very passionate about football. And of course, we have many problems, many developmental problems, political problems, protests. But they're very natural everywhere, especially in democratic countries. But I was also convinced that the animation that we have for football and the joy that we feel for football was going to prevail. And I think it is already prevailing.
It is prevailing in terms of the fact that the World Cup itself seems to be going incredibly well. But there was this large, very negative build-up up to the beginning of the World Cup where we had very obvious problems, the deaths of workers. At one point, we had FIFA's Sepp Blatter saying that this preparation was the worst he'd ever seen. Do you think that Brazil had a particularly bad criticism in terms of its build-up? Or were there genuine issues here that were either unexpected or weren't dealt with as the way they should have been?
Well, there is a combination of things. But you have to take into account that Brazil is a country very, very introspective and very much Brazilian. Every country is its own, but Brazil is very Brazilian. And by that, I mean that if you are taking a Swiss evaluation in Brazil, you might be surprised, as you would be if you're taking a Brazilian evaluation of other countries. So in our minds, everything was going to work well, and we did not feel very adequately treated. But I think that this is due to, you know, a certain sort of lack of latitude in the vision of people who were presenting complaints.
Just considering this idea of Brazil thinking that they're going to get everything right, but the rest of the world asking lots of questions, to what degree was this then a big challenge for Brazil to suddenly find itself in the spotlight, to host an event that many are saying it's the biggest international event you've ever staged, and suddenly have to step up in terms of your soft power and not be introspective and not be quite so Brazilian?
Well, you know, the event is huge. Not because of the logistics, in spite of the logistics also are complicated. It is huge because of the global audience. As you know, nothing comes close to the World Cup, not even the Olympics, not any type of event. We expect 30 billion cumulative TV audience for this. And it's not just because it's in Brazil. In the previous World Cup, the Cup since Japan-Korea, the audience has been above 25 billion. So it's very, very big. But Brazil is used to hosting very big events. Just Carnival, for instance, you have daily more than 1 million people in the streets of Rio alone. All over Brazil, you can the 31 December party in Rio has 2.5, 3 million people in the beach. So it's not something we are not used to. But of course, we are under the eyes of the world for this event, and this creates different challenges. And of course, things could have been better in many dimensions. But overall, what will remain is how the games were played, how the logistics were during the World Cup itself, if the flights were complicated, which has not been the case so far. So we're very confident that the last, which is the lasting impression, is going to be very positive.
That's the lasting impression of the World Cup and the way it was organised. What do you believe will be the lasting impression of Brazil itself, given the focus that was very, very keenly trained on the way that Brazilian society operates, that we had military deployment into the favelas, documentaries appearing on British television about child prostitution in the shadow of the new stadiums, a failure to be ready, and these protests that have been going for, what, more than a year, almost 2 years now. This was not the Brazil that a lot of people expected to see in the build-up.
Well, it's quite true. I think the most unexpected thing was a reaction, a negative reaction of many people in relation to the World Cup and the hosting of the World Cup. I think this was unexpected. We are not, unused to prejudice and to have, different parts of Brazil overblown, as was the case in many of the documentaries we saw. Not to say that some of them are not very well made, but obviously they're just showing a partial side of Brazil. But Brazil is a developing country with huge challenges and developing problems. But it's also a country with enormous confidence. You know, a country without problems doesn't exist. Of course, we may even have larger problems than others, but I think a good country is not a country without problems, but is a country with confidence that we can overcome the problems.
And how are you going to overcome these problems with this confidence? Because a lot of them seem incredibly endemic in society.
Well, one of the big advantages of being in a developing country, contrary to already established societies, is that the challenges are very, very clear. And you know what has to be done. And in Brazil, we face challenges related to education, to health, to transportation, to security, all elements that have to be superseded. But the fact is that we've come a long way already. If you look at what happened in the past, how we were 10, 15, 20 years ago, where we are now, you would see enormous progress in the country.
And finally, we have but little moments left to talk, but it is what, kickoff at 2000 hours. You're very, very smartly dressed at the moment, as an ambassador should. What will be happening at 2000 hours in the ambassadorial residence?
Well, we obviously, everybody watching the game, there's something that is always very present in Brazil. I am a football enthusiast. I like football. I like to see as many of the World Cup matches as I can. They are a delight to watch because of the tense moments that they generate, the beauty that they generate. And obviously, I'm going to be in a much more casual manner in the house.
I do sincerely hope so. Thank you very much indeed for your time, the Brazil ambassador to the United Kingdom, Roberta Jaguaribe. Thank you very much indeed for coming to Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Монако 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Монако 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост. Се е Монако 24.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Монако 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Монако 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, where the time here in London is 18:47. Time now for our weekly music review, and our guest today is a man of many talents. Sin Kane, or Ahmed Galab to his friends, is a multi-instrumentalist you may have seen on stage with artists including Yeser of Montreal and Caribou. But now he's stepping out of the shadows and about to release his third full-length album, Mean Love. It's a blend of futuristic funk, which is as inspired by his Brooklyn surroundings as his Sudanese heritage. He's currently flying about on a DJ tour, but he found time to sit down with Monocle's Paul Noble to talk music and more.
I like to wing it depending on where I'm DJing and kind of feel the crowd out a little bit and just feel the vibe and the energy of the room and just kind of take it from there. Sometimes it's pretty dancey, sometimes it can be pretty down tempo. I like to just kind of take the energy of the people and bring back the music that I feel out of it.
We're going to get into your album in a moment, but let's just kick off first of all with some music. You've picked three tracks today. Mm-hmm. First one is J Tram, one of your close collaborators.
Yeah, Jay's the drummer of Sin Kane, and I met him a few years ago when we were both playing with Yeser. And the thing about him that's so inspiring is his music is an absolute sonic interpretation of his spirit and the kind of person that he is. It's very spiritual. It's incredibly melodic and colorful, and melds a lot of different kinds of things together in this beautiful kind of collage. And I'm a huge fan of his music, and recently he's been starting to make his own tracks and not just small little blips and bloops or whatever. I just want the whole world to hear it because I think it's so fascinating.
Okay, so this is from J Tram. This is Here and Now.
I live for so long in this dream, by
we
And that was Jay Tram. You can find that on his Bandcamp page. And I saw him recently on stage with you at the Barbican at really one of the most incredible gigs I've ever seen, which was the William Onyebor Atomic Bomb Show. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a... Thank you, first of all. But that was an amazing opportunity that I got from the guys from Luwaka Pop, who released the William Onyebor compilation this past year, and also a compilation a few years ago where I heard William Onyebor for the first time. His music has been incredibly inspiring to me, and it's helped me kind of form and understand what I wanted to do with Sin Cane from the early kind of moments of Sin Cane. Being the musical director for this project was a huge challenge because I'm so obsessed with his music, and I understand it in this very like obsessive and, you know, infatuated way that I just really did not want to sell it short at all. And we had a really good time learning all the music, and it was an honor to be on stage with such amazing musicians. And I think we all did a really good job.
Well, you definitely looked like the man in charge on the night. Everyone was looking at you for their cues.
Yeah, it was definitely a James Brown kind of situation.
Yeah. I hope no one got fined at the end.
No.
It sounded pretty tight. We're just going to go from Jay Tram to Wally Badaroo, and there's comparisons there musically, even though this was, you know, nearly 30 years ago, his album Echoes. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be a line between the two of them. Let's listen to a bit of it and then come back to you. From 1983, Wally Badaroo with Jungle, and that's from the album Echoes. There seems to be sort of Wally Badaroo is like a name which comes around every so often.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something sort of at once futuristic and quite naive and touches of Africa, but Africa in the diaspora.
Yep.
Seems to touch all sorts of bases.
Mm-hmm.
What was your link with him?
I'm incredibly fascinated by African musicians who have a strong set of parameters around them that kind of like try to shatter, you know, this idea of like what it is to be an African musician, you know. And I think the technology that was presented to the world in music in the 80s, you know, with electronic music, was completely taken on by African musicians and taken to like a whole nother level, you know. Like, it was way, way far beyond its time. William Onyebor is a great example of that. Wally Badaroo is a great example of that. And Francis Bebe is also a very great example of that. Manu Dibango, all those guys. I'm so drawn to that because it just shows how creative you can get when you have, you know, you're living in an oppressed country or like a struggling community, and you have this technology that's far beyond your grasp, and you take it and you turn it into this very, very beautiful thing. And Echoes is an album that does that so amazingly.
And you've got Sudanese roots and family in Sudan as well.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Time to talk about your album, which is what we're here to do.
Sure, why not?
Sure, why not? It's called Mean Love, and there are traces of sort of African rhythms and some instrumentation in it. Tell us a bit about the recording process of that album and how you picked these songs to be on it.
I spent a lot of time, you know, sitting in this metal desk in Brooklyn, New York, with a laptop and, you know, my headphones, and just tracking loads and loads and loads of ideas, you know, and sending them back to my friend Greg LaFaro, who helped me co-produce this album. From the beginning of the album, I really wanted to establish myself as an artist that wasn't just this ex-member of this person's band or someone who is a sideman for someone else. And I felt like I really needed to take it seriously with this record. And that presented the question to me of what exactly is my music? And my answer was I wanted to make truly universal music. You know, I spent a lot of time traveling growing up. My family had emigrated to the United States, and beyond being emigrating to the United States, we traveled a lot and got to experience many different cultures and many different people. And through touring, I've done the same thing. And I just wanted to take all those experiences and bring them into the music and kind of give it to the world such that people could listen to it and have their own interpretation, and they could relate to the music in their own way. And I could make music that everyone could enjoy. So I spent a lot of time kind of sifting through all of these experiences that I had and through touring and through traveling and made this album.
Well, I've heard previews and bits and bobs of it already, and I've heard the lead single, Hold Tight, which we'll hear in a second. It's sounding really fantastic. I'm looking forward to hearing it everywhere this summer.
Thank you very much.
So, Sinkane, this is Hold Tight.
And that was Sinkane, and that track was called Hold Tight, otherwise known as the DJ and musician Ahmed Galab, in conversation with Paul Noble. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Xenia Dormandy and Alessio Patilano. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra Stenbock-Firma, and our studio manager was Bill Lutie. Next up, after the headlines, is our weekly design show, Section D. Your host for that will be Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours, is the Monocle Daily. Ted Kravitz and Andrew Muller slugging it out together in Studio One tonight. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.